From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Hacktivism. Today, a look at the case of computer hacker and journalist Emmanuel Goldstein, who's being sued by major Hollywood studios. Also, in the wake of the Philadelphia police beating of an African-American man, a look at Philly's security preparations for the Republican National Convention. We'll speak with the deputy police commissioner. And we go to Okinawa, where thousands have gathered to protest the G8 summit meeting. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Early morning drama at Camp David, Maryland, has kept the Middle East peace hopes alive. A short time after the White House announced that the summit talks had collapsed, President Clinton appeared before reporters this morning to announce that the Israelis and Palestinians had decided to keep talking. President Clinton headed off then to the G8 summit in Japan, where thousands of protesters have already arrived. Demonstrators today formed a chain around a major U.S. airbase on Okinawa to protest the American military presence on the Japanese island. In some areas, protesters stood 3 and 4 deep. There have been no reports of arrests or incidents. Clinton is to be the first U.S. president to visit Okinawa, which was governed by Washington after Japan's surrender in World War II. The U.S. has continued using Okinawa as a major overseas military outpost, but many residents think the U.S. presence is too heavy. The summit will run from tomorrow through Sunday. Later in the program, we'll go to Okinawa and we'll speak with an activist there. A Republican committee chair wants the Justice Department to investigate whether Vice President Al Gore advised that Clinton friend and Indonesian mogul James Riady be allowed to view Democratic TV ads during a visit to the White House. According to Republican Congressmember Dan Burton, Gore can be heard making the suggestion about Riady and a White House videotape. In a letter to Attorney General Janet Reno this week, Burton wrote, "It would indeed be extraordinary for the Vice President to suggest showing political issue advertisements to an Indonesian billionaire who lives in Jakarta, Indonesia." Riady was one of the central figures in the campaign fundraising scandal of 1996. He's currently under criminal investigation by the Justice Department's Campaign Finance Task Force. Burton said the Justice Department has chosen to ignore the information about Gore's comment, which the congressman supplied the department, he said, a very long time ago. Meanwhile, U.S. activists are protesting the fact that the U.S. has begun this week joint military exercises with Indonesia. The United States is denying they serve a military purpose, saying they involve, among other things, community relations projects and dental operations. Gosh, getting the truth out of the U.S. government can be like pulling teeth. Well, according to the Washington Post, an email message from an aide to Hillary Clinton urged supporters of her New York Senate campaign to call reporters for two Jewish newspapers to, quote, "let them know that you know Hillary and know she would never make an anti-Semitic remark like the one that a new book accuses her of making 26 years ago. The email continues, quote, "It's important that you do not say you're calling because the campaign asked you to, but because you're outraged with what was said about her." The message was addressed to, quote, "Jewish advisory group" with the subject line, "Rapid response to charges of anti-Semitism." She was accused of saying 26 years ago to a campaign staffer in a failed congressional bid of her husband, now President Clinton, of calling him a blanking Jew bastard. Activists who have set their sights on this summer's Democratic National Convention scored a victory yesterday when a federal judge said city officials must give protesters better access to the convention site. U.S. District Judge Gary Fease agreed with the American Civil Liberties Union, which sued the city and police department. The suit claimed a wide buffer zone officials planned to establish around the convention site, the downtown Staples Center, would violate protesters' constitutional rights by keeping keeping them too far from delegates. Fee's decision, which will be made final in a ruling today, affirmed activists' contention that the existing security plan violated their free speech rights. The ACLU had asked for a temporary injunction to prevent the city and police from implementing the buffer zone. A nuclear storage base in Seneca Falls, New York, which in the 1980s was revealed by defense analysts to be home to the nation's largest army stockpile of nuclear missiles, will be officially closed today. After 59 years as a major East Coast storage site for everything from bullets to radar-evading cruise missiles, post-Cold War budget cuts are finally shutting the place down. The last military commander was shipping out today. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today on the program, we're going to take a look at the preparations for the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia, as well as what's happening in Los Angeles with the Democrats. Activists have been conducting training exercises and workshops for the planned street protests, while Philadelphia police, as well as federal agencies like the FBI, have been conducting their own training. We're joined on the telephone right now by Deputy Commissioner Robert Mitchell of the Philadelphia Police Department. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, it's good to have you with us. There have been major protests that have been taking place. I guess top police officials ran into the wrath of the community just two nights ago at a community meeting over the beating of the African-American man at the hands of a group of police officers, some are saying a mob of police officers. And your police commissioner, John Timoney, faced down this angry crowd where black leaders were demanding answers over the beating of Thomas Jones. How are you dealing with this building protest in light of the we're just days away from the Republican convention?
Well, I'm not so sure I agree with it. It's a building protest. It's not lost on us that are involved in the planning of the RNC. It never has been lost on us because that was just simply one aspect of it. The other equally area of concern for us was the strong presence of the media, the tremendous quantity of video cameras that were going to be out there, both the media and both by the protesters' own media system. And all this is, and I don't say so much the national media, but I know with regard to the the demonstrators' media system is going to be a gotcha kind of an arrangement. But I don't want to make it sound in my remarks like it's us against them, and I don't want to move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. We're also joined by Sarah Scully, who's founder of Eyewitness Video, who is in studio here with us in New York conducting trainings of video activists to monitor the activities of police. A gotcha arrangement?
I'm not quite sure I'm clear on what that means exactly. Could you clarify that for me?
Sure, I have no problem clarifying that. Just observe some kind of a situation developing between either a demonstrator slash protester and a police officer or police officers, and just watching it take form. and the possible shouting of the word, and trying to just get the police officers sufficiently worked up to generate a reaction, and just stay there, be patient, and just watch it develop. And then when it develops, that's when the picture is taken. That's when the video is put on. Not in advance of it that shows what may have led up to it. Now, that does not mean that the police officers or police reaction to it is anything that we're pleased with.
What are your reasons for putting video cameras on the streets and training activists to go down?
Well, our experience coming out of Seattle and the protest in Washington, D.C. is not that the protesters get the police worked up. It's that the police actually corner the protesters and get the protesters into a situation where they're provoking frustration on the part of the protesters. No protester wants to provoke being hit and kicked and beaten by a police officer. And my personal experience being a media person in D.C. was witnessing this police brutality, and while I was filming it, the police turned on me and hit me.
This was during the World Bank IMF protests?
Yes. And when that officer hit me, I realized that we not only need to have people filming the police so that we get these things on camera, but we need to have people who are trained and skilled in how to avoid the police turning on them. So when you say, you know, the protesters getting worked up and setting the cops up, it's really the other way around. So our intention is to have a team of people who are trained and skilled in how to keep themselves focused and calm and safe and focused particularly on the police and what they are doing.
Well, that goes to the heart of my thing, particularly on the police. In other words, the police, without any kind of provocation, without any kind of reason, all of a sudden just get turned loose, so to speak. I happen to have been in Washington for those 2 days, and there was a great deal of frustration on the part of the demonstrators because I was back behind the barricade lines.
You were observing what was happening there in preparation for the Republican convention?
Yes, in that respect, yes. But what my take on it, and of course, you know, Sarah and I are coming from two different perspectives here, and what it was just a deep sense of frustration that the police were thwarting them in their efforts to try to carry out, you know, their mandate, their mission. What they wanted to do was to interrupt both of those functions that were occurring that weekend.
Let me follow up for a minute on the issue of the Philadelphia police, you going to Washington to observe the protesters during the World Bank IMF protests. We also had a report in the beginning of May that the New York police worked with the Philadelphia police who came up for a May Day rally, and that undercover Philadelphia cops photographed about 20 demonstrators at the May Day rally. Part of Philadelphia police strategy to identify troublemakers who they said are planning to attend the Republican National Convention. That was actually a paraphrase of Philadelphia Police Commissioner John Timoney. Are you going to places like New York and photographing protesters in preparation?
Are we? No. Had we? Yes. That particular occasion.
Why?
For just the reason you just cited, for the reason that the commissioner just gave.
I want to go back to this other issue of, you know, you brought up this dynamic between the protesters getting frustrated and, you know, the police acting on the protesters because the protesters are acting out. The fact of the matter is, no matter what protesters are doing, whether doing civil disobedience and exercising their right to free speech in the streets, or whether they're locking down somewhere, or even whether they're breaking a window, the police have no right to beat protesters and to brutalize protesters. And that's what we've seen time and again in Seattle and D.C. And that is what we're concerned about in Philadelphia. The police have no right when they're apprehending an individual, whether they're legally apprehending that person or illegal, no matter what the grounds are, they have no right to brutalize that individual. And that's what we've constantly seen. And I think that's what you need to focus on.
Deputy Police Commissioner Robert Mitchell.
How can I quarrel with that? Who can argue with that?
Well, then,
I'm not disagreeing with
Sarah.
Can
you explain why it happens time and again? You're a professional in this field. I'm sure you've been a distinguished professional in this field for many years. You tell me. I mean, I know that the police, the culture is not a Lone Ranger culture. It's not a guy making a decision to beat somebody. Everyone's dispatched. It's like a football team. You have a strategy. You deploy men in certain areas and women of the police to quell protests. Then why does this happen? Are you telling me everybody's in a bad mood so they decide to beat on people?
Sarah, you know, I don't think we'll ever completely see eye to eye on all the issues here. But let me get back to your issue. When we talk about the protesters, do you have any problem accounting for all of the behavior of all of the protesters that can be under a particular group that you're willing to account for all of their behavior and speak for all their behavior? No. Are there not a certain element within that demonstration group that present a problem for the organizers, that give them some gray hair, that give them some embarrassment?
The fact of the matter is, Deputy...
You set out not to do that, don't you? Don't they set out to run a peaceful, orderly event
right,
to try to get the message
right.
out?
But the fact of the matter is, Deputy
go
Commissioner...
Awry because of the frustration of some of these other people?
Deputy Commissioner Mitchell, the fact of the matter is, I don't have to account for the individuals who are protesting. I don't license them to have guns and badges. I don't train them to arrest individuals in a civil manner. And when they sign up to do that, they're not signing up to do those activities in a civil manner. They each are accountable to themselves, and they each speak for themselves. I don't speak for the protest movement, but your police officers have badges and licenses. So that makes it even more important for them and you to be responsible for their activities.
Deputy Police Commissioner Robert Mitchell and Sarah Scully, founder of Eyewitness Video, we are also joined on the telephone by Reverend Vernal Sims, pastor of the Morris Brown AME Church in Philadelphia. He is one of the black clergy who were at the community meeting two nights ago where leaders in Philadelphia were demanding answers over the beating of Thomas Jones. Reverend Vernal Sims, can you talk about
yes.
your concerns right now involving the Philadelphia police?
Well, our concern involving the Philadelphia police at this point is the fact that we just want a fair investigation into the matter. People characterize us as defending Thomas Jones. We are not defending Thomas Jones. He needed to be apprehended. We are not defending him, but we are defending his civil rights. We're defending the fact that he was shot four or five times, the fact that he was beaten, kicked, and dragged away in a headlock, not putting in an ambulance going to the hospital, but putting in a car going to the hospital. So our concern is the fact that of his civil rights. We're not defending him.
Deputy Police Commissioner Robert Mitchell, in addition to the actual beating of Thomas Jones, you had the situation a few days ago of a police officer out of a precinct selling these T-shirts of the beating that was caught on videotape, where it said RNC Welcoming Committee, and on the back, and it has a picture of a police badge, it says Welcome America, with the commander of the precinct not objecting. What's happening here?
Well, as Reverend Sims knows, and he is a highly respected member of the clergy here in the city, that concern that he had and the other black clergy had has certainly been addressed by the police commissioner, and what I think by any definition would certainly be very, very strong language. And I would ask you, you know, to ask the, you know, Reverend Sims about that. I think the commissioner has met with the Reverend. He's tried to the extent that he can, share with him what has gone, what the department is doing, and leave him, and I believe he's left him, the Reverend can speak for himself, but left him with a sense that we are embarrassed by this. We will, hold on one second, please.
I'm on national radio.
Go on, I'm sorry, go ahead. I apologize for that. But the...
Police Commissioner, we have to break. Deputy Police Commissioner,
okay, well,
we have
thank
to break
you very
for.
Much
no, no,
for
no,
the
no, no, no. If you can stay with us for 1 minute, we just have to break for a minute for stations to identify themselves, and we'd like to take 2 more minutes of your time. Is that okay?
Go ahead.
Okay. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're talking with Deputy Police Commissioner Robert Mitchell, also Reverend Vernal Sims and Sarah Scully. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about plans for Philadelphia, the Republican National Convention begins on July 31st. Democracy Now! Will be there broadcasting daily live programs. Deputy Police Commissioner Robert Mitchell, a question about your plans next week. Will you be using, or will the Philadelphia police, do they have plans to use pepper spray, tear gas, or rubber bullets?
With that, no.
No?
No.
Has the police commissioner made a pledge that they will not use
these chemical agents? No. The police commissioner has said, and the reason I'm so quick to say no to you, Amy, is that the only case that gas of any type would be used if we're absolutely in a riotous situation. Absent that, it will not be used.
And what about the opening of the Holmesburg Prison, a notorious prison in Philadelphia, now only used by filmmakers looking for dungeon-like conditions for their movie sets? It was closed down, and word is that it'll open for the protesters.
Where did you get the word dungeon-type conditions?
That movie, that filmmakers use it?
Yes, now that you use the word dungeon-type conditions there, it's a little dramatic word to use, isn't it? I wouldn't characterize it that way, but to answer your question anyway, Amy, we have been forced, out of sheer necessity in preparing for this thing, to be prepared for a worst-case scenario. Or obviously, any police department's wish would be that you don't have a worst-case scenario, but we're obligated to plan for it. And in the event that the number of people that might get arrested exceeds the capacity of the police headquarters building to properly handle them, we have to have a facility where prisoners can be brought to until such time as they can be brought to police headquarters for processing.
Reverend Vernal Sims, a pastor of the Morris Brown AME Church, are you comfortable or feel confident about police behavior in these next few weeks in light of what has happened in the last week?
Oh, yes. Let me say that I must give Commissioner Timoney credit in the fact that as soon as this issue happened, he touched base with us. We went in and met with him, and in a matter of 2 days, we met three or four times along with him and the mayor. And we are not by any means, we want to make it clear that we want to live in a safe Philadelphia. We are not saying that all of the police are bad or all of the police are racist. And we just want those bad apples that are in the police department to be taken out of the police department and to be arrested and prosecuted for what they've done. We are looking forward to the Republican National Convention coming to Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a wonderful place to be and to live, and we want them to come in and enjoy themselves, spend their money, and help our economy.
Sarah Scully, founder of Eyewitness Video, you've been training activists to video police behavior and activities on the street. Your final concerns?
One of my final concerns comes out of my experience in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago. I spent a weekend there and actually just as a civilian kind of chatted with cops who were on the street patrolling with Greek Picnic. And When I chatted with them about their jobs in the summer and how they felt about the upcoming protests, a lot of them rolled their eyes and said, well, we're getting a lot of overtime this summer. They said that they're working 14-hour days, they're tired, and it's hot. And this really raised a red flag for me, because the report that came out about Seattle and how the police behaved in Seattle, one of the main findings...
This is the National Lawyers Guild report?
Yeah, ACLU report. One of the main findings was that police were not given adequate time to rest. They had been working overtime, and they hadn't been given adequate breaks for food. And I understand that, you know, there might be a promise to give police breaks, but I feel like I'd like that concern addressed about the fact that police have been working overtime, and in conditions in late July when it's going to be 8 hours in the sun, maybe in turtle suits, you know, riot gear. How are the police going to deal with that? I mean, that's just a basic logistical issue that can make people's tempers really hot and not good conditions for people thinking clearly and abiding by civil procedures for arrest.
Deputy Commissioner Robert Mitchell.
The issue of the turtle suits, it's been said since day one, no turtle suits. So I don't know why it's been brought up. It's a turtle suit. I know why the black clothing, very ominous looking stuff, the black, all that black gear.
Gas masks.
First of all, it's oppressive. And as Sarah said, rightly so, in the East Coast here, it's like being down in Florida. It's very, very hot and humid. That's not lost on us here. It's to the extent that circumstances permit. I mean, circumstances are going to dictate a lot of these things, but we're planning for to ensure that they're well hydrated, they're well fed, and trying to plan for release. We're a much larger police department than the city of Seattle, and we have committed more resources to this project. Lesson learned from Seattle. And the other point of it, too, is we're concerned about the fact that they could possibly be stressed. And as Sarah rightly brings out, it's a legitimate point that they start to get edgy. And that's not in our best interest to have that happen.
Question on the Philadelphia City Council ruling that people who wear any face covering like bandanas will be fined $75. What is that about?
It's something that's just not worth talking about, because what I mean by that, Amy, it's and I've had some discussions with the ACLU on that. We're not going to be going out and as we see people that'll choose to wear that, just pick them up and have them brought before a judge and fined for that. We're not looking to do that. But I would say that if somebody engages in criminal conduct and they are wearing a mask, that charge under the city ordinance will certainly be applied against them.
Another concern I have is the police attitudes towards protesters, because in my sort of fact-finding mission when I was in Philadelphia chatting with the police,
Sarah Scully,
one of them actually said, quote-unquote, about the protesters, well, I'm not looking forward to getting piss thrown at me. And they all laughed as if this was something they had all understood as a joke. And I'm just wondering where police are getting their information about protesters and about how they may behave. And I reminded them that, well, no piss had ever been thrown in Seattle or D.C. And D.C. was fairly peaceful, and there wasn't any riotous violence. So, you know, I'm just wondering sort of what the cops' attitudes are, and just hoping that the police understand what the protesters are doing and why they're there, and not have this sort of maybe power of presumption that can also cause problems with the police.
Sarah, it's in our best interest not to have confrontation. We don't gain from that. And I would submit to you that the protesting community does not gain from it either. Because the focus will not be on the issues that they feel so strongly about, but will be on the confrontation and the subsequent arrest and police action that follow. So it's not in our best interest. We are trying very hard. It's in my best interest as the overall commander to ensure that we arrest as few people as possible, and of course, in the ideal world, nobody getting arrested. We do not want confrontation. It is not in our best interest.
Reverend Vernal Sims, is there a rally planned at your church on Sunday
yes,
at the Morris Brown Amy Church?
We're having a rally on this Sunday at 7 p.m. at Morris Brown AME Church at 25th and Montgomery in North Philadelphia. And we're having it. We're having a prayer rally for the ecumenical community and the city of Philadelphia.
On that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Reverend Vernal Sims, pastor of Morris Brown AME Church, Deputy Commissioner Robert Mitchell of the Philadelphia Police Department, and Sarah Scully, founder of Eyewitness Video, who's conducting trainings of video activists to monitor the activities of police in Philadelphia. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to the G8 summit that's taking place in Okinawa. And before we go there, we're also going to speak with Kevin Danaher. In addition to the G8 summit, we're going to talk with him about the plans for Los Angeles. Kevin Danaher, are you with us?
Yeah, with you, Amy.
Kevin Danaher is author of the book Globalize This and one of the leading activists against globalization, and will be participating in the Los Angeles protests at the Democratic National Convention. What are the plans there, and how are police responding at this point?
Well, unfortunately, the LAPD are sort of living up to their reputations already. We just co-sponsored with some other organizations and the Ruckus Society a democracy training camp down in Malibu for about 100 young activists. And the county sheriffs, the LA County Sheriff's Department, had helicopters hovering over it taking photographs, which is totally stupid because if they had just come to the entrance, we would have ushered them in and they could have come in and shaken hands, met everybody there. These are totally open training camps where we teach people nonviolence, strict nonviolence. And as was pointed out, you know, this thing of throwing urine at the police, I don't know where this mythology gets created within the police department, but we do know certain facts. For example, the movement has already rented a convergence center in Los Angeles, a big four-story, 24,000 square foot building. Immediately, within the first week of us, you know, getting the operation up to speed, the L.A. police come in, actually from the Ramparts Division, interestingly enough, the one that's been, you know, most exposed for corruption. And they come in with all these questions about, let's see your lease, and did the fire marshal check this? And right away you think, well, if this were some dot-com startup, would the police be harassing it? No, of course not. And I think the way to bridge this and the Okinawa summit being, you know, the G8 leaders being hidden away, far away from any protesters, the basic issue here is inequality. On a global level, the richest 20% of the world's people consume 86% of the world's resources. Within the United States, the richest 1% of the population controls more wealth than the poorest 95%. The police get put in the middle to protect that inequality. If you look at U.S. law, most U.S. law is property law. And the police get put in this position, they're working class people getting paid working class salaries to do the job of the ruling class to hold the working class majority in place. If I asked my 10-year-old daughter, when there's confrontations between capitalists and workers, whose side do the police take? Whose side, who did the police come out and beat and tear gas? My 10-year-old will know the answer to that. So we have a very clear pattern historically of the police, even though they're public employees, they're supposed to be working for us, taking the side of the elite wealthy minority. I should point out that those, if you look at the family incomes of those convention delegates, both in Philadelphia and in Los Angeles, it's over $100,000 a year in income. The average family income in the United States is more like $35,000, $40,000. So these people do not represent the general population of the United States. And I think that's why half the population doesn't bother to vote. That's the basic problem, the divide, the inequality in this society and in the world economy. And unfortunately, it gets into this position where us protesters get beat on by the police trying to defend this inequality.
Kevin Danaher, one of the founders of Global Exchange, author of the book Globalize This, one of the leading protesters against globalization. As we talk not only about the protests at the Republican and Democratic National Convention, but about protests that are taking place in Japan right now with the group of eight summit of the world's richest nations beginning in Okinawa, Japan. Activists are planning anti-globalization protests, but the demonstrations will undoubtedly be overshadowed by protests over a major issue in Japan itself, and that is the massive U.S. military presence there. People from Okinawa say they'll try to draw the world's attention to their outrage over the activities of U.S. Marines and other soldiers on their land and the fact that they don't want the U.S. military in Okinawa. Today, peace activists formed a 25,000-person human chain around the U.S. Marine base, calling for the U.S. to get out. They also carried red ribbons with messages that included no more U.S. bases, no more weapons, no more military accidents, no more GI rapes, no more misery. We're going to go to Okinawa right now with Suzuyo Takasato, who is co-chair of the Okinawa Women Against Military Violence and an elected representative to the Naha City Council of Okinawa. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Suzuyo Takasato. Welcome. Can you tell us why you're in Okinawa and part of this human chain today?
Well, because we felt that this must be the good chance to show our very strong desire that Okinawa will be the island without military base, military violence. So you said today, 27,000 people gathered, and we succeeded to encircle Kadena Air Base.
I don't know if people remember, but the wave of protest was unleashed 5 years ago by a GI abduction and rape of a 12-year-old girl. 4 years after 92% of Okinawan voters called for the withdrawal of U.S. bases. Can you explain how that rape 5 years ago affects your perceptions today?
Well, we really wanted our land to be freed from military violence. But after 4 years now, 5 years now, actually the situation is the same. And then U.S. government and Japanese government, they set aside and then they made to create some improvement for Okinawa, they said. And it was written in final report of Special Action Committee on Okinawa, which called SACO. But the results really disappointing. Actually, it's not for us. It's really to reorganize and re-strengthen the presence of U.S. military base. And the situation is just the same. And besides, 2 years ago, two governments agreed on relocating Futenma Air Station to northern part of Okinawa, which is a very beautiful seaside, and where the special species dugong live. And we are really against of this relocation. And besides, 2 weeks ago, July 3rd, again, 14-year-old girl, she was,
molested,
sexually assaulted, and in the midst of her bedroom. And that's, we really feel that it's more than enough. And because of those things, and not only those crime committed by U.S. military personnel, but almost, all the exercise accidents, tremendous noise, constant noise every day. Although these, the 3 days while these summits are going, no exercise planned. Suzuyo, you know, all the leaders will have a very quiet conference, but we are really feel that it's really more than half a year, and if it's enough.
Suzuyo Takezato, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. She is chair of the co-chair. She is co-chair of the Okinawa Women Against Military Violence. And we come back, we'll be joined by Gwen Kirk, who is a member of the Bay Area Okinawa Peace Network. And finally, we're going to find out about a court case, a lawsuit that's taking place today in New York against a computer hacker and journalist, Emmanuel Goldstein. Why is Hollywood so angry at him? You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the G8 summit, what isn't getting as much attention is the level of protest that is going on there, a 25,000-person human chain around the area today, people from all over Japan gathering around the U.S. Marine base calling for the U.S. to get out. Our guest, Suzuyo Takezato, co-chair of the Okinawa Women Against Military Violence, 5 years ago, three GIs abducted a 12-year-old girl and raped her 3 weeks ago. A 14-year-old girl was molested as a GI broke into her house, a drunken Marine. We're also joined on the phone by Gwen Kirk, a member of the Bay Area Okinawa Peace Network. She's just returned from a women's peace summit in Okinawa. Gwen Kirk, your impressions of the level of activism there and the major demands?
Well, Okinawa people are very determined that the U.S. bases will go. They've actually been campaigning for this on and off since 1945 with a lot of demonstrations over the years, protests, sit-ins, you know, referendum, and that kind of thing. So I see this human chain that Suzuyo Takezato is talking about today around Kadena Air Force Base as, you know, the latest really outpouring of opposition to U.S. military occupation, basically, of Okinawa.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. If people, Gwen Kirk, want to find out more about these protests here in this country, where can they call or go on the web?
The Asia-Pacific Center for Justice and Peace in Washington, D.C. has some of this information on their website, which is www.apcjp.org. They can call me here in San Francisco if they want to, area code 415-550-7947. We, as you mentioned, held a women's summit in Okinawa a few weeks ago to put demands of a different kind of security, not the military security that's really a central element of the world economic system presided over by the G8 nations. And our notions of a redefined security are very simple, really, that the environment in which we live must be able to sustain life, that our basic survival needs for food, clothing, shelter, etc., must be met, that people's fundamental human dignity and respect for cultural identities should be honored, and that people and the natural environment must be protected from avoidable harm.
Well, on that note, Gwen Kirk and Suzuyo Takezato, I want to thank you both for being with us as we move now into our last segment of the program, turning to a story that has a hacker journalist pitted against the power and money of Hollywood. It's the story of Eric Corley, who uses the name Emmanuel Goldstein, leader of the underground in George Orwell's 1984. He's the editor of 2600, the Hacker's Quarterly, and host of the radio program Off the Hook at Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York, where we're broadcasting from. And he's currently being sued in a federal court here by some of the biggest movie studios in the country. It's the case of Universal Studios, Paramount Pictures, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios, TriStar Pictures, Columbia Pictures, Time Warner Entertainment, and 20th Century Fox versus Eric Corley. His alleged crime, posting a computer program called DECSS, Decode Content Scrambling System, on the 2600 website. That program lets users circumvent the copy protection system of DVDs. The program originally was developed in Europe to enable users of the Linux operating system to play DVDs on their computers. Makers of other major operating systems, such as those made by Microsoft and Apple Computer, pay fees to give users access to DVD unscrambling software. But Linux, as an open source system, has no central selling body and relies on its global army of volunteer programmers. This has enraged the Motion Picture Association of America, Hollywood's lobbying group. They say the program could be used to copy and distribute DVDs without compensation. We're going to turn now to Emmanuel Goldstein, who I spoke to just after he came off his program Off the Hook on Tuesday night. I asked him if this case is not about piracy and illegal copying like the movie industry alleges. What is it all about?
Well, it's about control of DVDs. It's not about copying like they're trying to portray to the media. Basically, what they're trying to do is take technology and make it so that you can only play DVDs under certain circumstances. You buy a DVD and you try to use it on your computer, you could be breaking the law, even though you've bought the DVD and you've bought the computer. And they're trying to use the copyright law, a new copyright law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, to back this up. It's something that has never happened before, yet they're trying to make it seem as if this is what copyright is all about.
Wait, you have to explain this. You buy a DVD, even that I think some people can't understand, but they might see it in the video store. Mm-hmm. It's a new kind of video?
Well, yeah, it's basically a digital versatile disc. It's going to replace videotapes at some point. They look just like CDs. But let me explain it in a way that people might be able to understand who have not gotten into that at all. Let's say you buy a CD. Most people know what CDs are now. And you buy this CD in England. Well, if that was a DVD, you would not be allowed to play it in the United States. You could only play it on players in the country that you bought it in. They can go further than that. They can force you to watch commercials on these DVDs because many times if you rent something at a video store, you'll get advertisements at the beginning or promotions at the beginning. They can make it so that you can't skip that. And if you try to skip that, if you figure out a way to bypass it, that's bypassing the copyright protection. And that's what this is about, people figuring out ways to use the technology the way they want to use it rather than the way they're being told they have to use it. It's got nothing to do with copying because you could always copy DVDs from day one. In fact, you can go out in the street and find DVDs that are pirated. You can find videotapes all over the place that are pirated. That's not their issue. And if it were, they would be cracking down on these people. Instead, they're dragging us into court because, and we didn't even figure this out ourselves. All we did was print it as journalists that this was happening, that the encryption was cracked, that people were being threatened with their net access, with their jobs, with their education. People were being thrown out of school for having this source code on their website. And it's a really scary McCarthyist type of a thing when people can be prosecuted for writing or for posting something on their website that explains how something works. And that's why we took an interest in the story. And not surprisingly, we became the threat as soon as we did that.
So explain exactly what happened and who has taken you to court.
What happened was the Motion Picture Association of America in January succeeded in getting a preliminary injunction against us to remove the source code from our site. Now, they've tried since to extend that to what is known as links. Basically, a link is something pointing you to another site where you can get this information.
Explain what the source code is that you've posted.
The source code basically shows how CSS, which is the encryption scheme used in DVDs, how CSS was cracked. And I'd have to get into really technical issues as to what precisely that is. But the short story is, it's source code that tells you how weak their encryption system was. They want to erase that. They want to make it as if it never happened, even though their encryption has been cracked. You can't go back. You can't say, oh, well, it's really okay. Just everybody forget that it was cracked. That's what they're trying to do.
And by breaking the code, it allows you to view parts of the DVD and not view other parts of the DVD?
Cracking the code allows you to have control over how you play back the DVD. It doesn't make it easy to copy in any sense. You could always copy. Let me explain this in terms of encrypted files. If you have an encrypted file and you copy it, you still have an encrypted file that can be read by the decryptor. So what people have been doing over the years is simply copying DVDs encrypted and playing them back in basically any DVD player, which decrypts them. It's that simple. Decrypting that does not allow you to copy DVDs in any easy fashion whatsoever. What it does allow you to do is get past those restrictions saying that you can't play your DVD on a computer, that you can only play it on a certain type of player in a certain country under certain conditions. It's equivalent to, say, you buy a CD and it's on Sony, and you can only play it back in a Sony player. You can't play it back in an RCA player. You have to buy a different one for that. It's not quite at that stage yet, but this kind of a law would allow for that to happen.
What are you charged with?
I'm charged with violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act by providing access to something that is designed to circumvent a copyright protection. It's a very long way of saying that we publish source code that allows you to figure out how encryption works, or in this case, didn't work.
And so is this a felony?
It's a civil case. So right now we're going through the federal court downtown, and we're trying to figure out how to convince the judge that what these people are saying is just utter nonsense. These guys, our opponents, have a lot of money. They have a lot of lawyers. I was in their building, and they're in Times Square, and they have every single floor of a 25-story building. It's a really frightening thing. Basically, It's an uphill battle, and we have to convince a lot of people what's going on. It could turn into a criminal case at some point. They already managed to arrest somebody in Norway because he was suspected of writing the source code, as if that's a crime, writing something. But that's what we're moving into, where if you write down something on a piece of paper, you could be arrested.
We're talking to Emmanuel Goldstein, who is on trial now in Manhattan court, being brought to court by the Motion Picture stands for what?
Motion Picture Association of America.
By the Motion Picture Association of America. Now, one of their comments is if they had understood that their movies on DVD could be played on the computer, they never would have put this on DVD?
No, you see, they don't lose. That's the funny thing here. They lose nothing. We've said in the many protests that we've been to, we're not their enemy, we're their customers. We're trying to play back what we have bought legally on a device which we have also bought legally. However, what they want to do is they want to milk every single company they can for a licensing fee and say that you're not allowed to support a DVD player on your computer operating system unless you pay us $1 million or whatever the fee is. And a lot of programmers don't have that kind of money, so they write their own ways around this kind of thing. It's how the net was built. So it's a really bullying way to try and get as much money as they can from these people. I mean, they're already making a fortune, but they seem to want to increase this even more and expand into this world and hide behind copyright and claim that that's what they're doing when they're not.
Mm-hmm. Are you the only person being sued?
Well, I'm the only one left because, really, this kind of a thing is extremely stressful. And they had tried suing someone who was an internet service provider who had lots of customers he had to worry about, and just, you know, high school kids, people like that. I mean, these are real bullies out here. We're talking, when we say the Motion Picture Association of America, we're talking about the companies they represent, which is Time Warner, which is Disney, which is Paramount, all the companies. We're talking about 8 major motion picture studios here. And these guys, they own the media. They own everything. So we're not going up just against one company here. We're going up virtually against every major studio in America and all the things that they own beyond that, including newspapers and television stations and radio stations. Now, we're just 2600. We're just a hacker quarterly. We can't back down. If we did, the cost would be much greater than anything we could possibly get by losing. So we have to fight this out to the end, because if we lose this, everybody loses. Everybody loses the right to think for themselves, to write things, to figure out how technology works. It's a very bad precedent. And in fact, people at the protest on Monday were talking to a congressman who walked by, and he was amazed that such a thing could even be passed into law. And I don't think the people who signed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act had this in mind when it was originally written. We're seeing companies abusing this, trying to really milk it for all it's worth and completely misconstrue what it's all about.
How does this differ from the Napster controversy, which is you can go online, you can download music, so you're not buying the record or CD, and you can listen to it?
Mm-hmm. Well, Napster is a completely different case. Napster basically is a company. DECSS is a program. And that's really the major difference right there. Napster has a business going where they sell things to do this. And I'm not going to judge one way or another whether or not what they're doing is right, because it's completely unrelated to this case. What DECSS is simply a program that somebody else wrote. And they are the only people, as far as I can see, that have a right to a copyright of that program and can tell people to take it off their websites. Instead, the MPAA feels that because that program defeats their program, that they can outlaw it. And that's not how it's worked up until now. Basically, they're changing the rules and trying to make it so that if you write something that figures out a way to bypass something else, then that's illegal and you could be prosecuted for that.
Now, sorry for my being so dense, but this program that was written allows you then to take home a DVD disc, like a CD, but it's also visual, it's also video. And do what?
It allows you to take a DVD, which we assume you've already purchased, and if you have a Linux machine, you can play it on your computer now. In addition to your TV set, you can play it on your computer. Now, you can play it on a Microsoft system. You can play it on a Macintosh. They allow that because they've already paid huge amounts of money for the right to have a DVD player on their operating system. But there's other open source operating systems, such as Linux and FreeBSD and all that kind of thing, and they don't have the same access, because they weren't given this access. We never had this with CD players. You could play a CD player on any operating system. But now DVDs, they see a way of making even more money by restricting who can play things back. It's a concept that we're not even familiar with, so it's very hard to compare it to something. So that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with not being allowed to play something on a computer that you own, when that's what DVDs were designed to be. That's how they were designed to be played, on computers and on TV sets.
And who is representing you?
I'm happy to say I've got Martin Garbus representing me, who's represented such people as Spike Lee and Lenny Bruce and all kinds of civil rights cases. This guy really gets it. He understands how it all comes together and the importance of it.
Eric Corley, a.k.a. Emmanuel Goldstein, the editor of 2600. You can go to 2600.com. He is currently being sued by the Motion Picture Association of America. And that does it for today's program. Tomorrow, I'll be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and broadcasting from station KUNM. I look forward to seeing listeners tonight and going out to Santa Fe tomorrow night. We'll be looking at the nuclear industry, the latest scandals around Los Alamos Labs. That's tomorrow on Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. We had help today from Nell Geiser and Deepa Fernandez. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. You can email us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Monument. Death.